This is Life Rattle. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight on Life Rattle number 1177, we present four dry, wry, edgy snapshots of the human condition. Life Rattle classics written and read by Virginia Ashbury. Virginia Ashbury was born in Toronto in 1952, the youngest of three children. She left home at 17, married on her 19th birthday, and had three children. She left her husband, took the kids when they were 8, 6, and 3 years old, and went to live in Peterborough on mother's allowance, where she went to university. In 1985, Ashbury sold everything she had and drove the three kids across Canada to Victoria, BC. She returned 6 weeks later to face the issues in Toronto she realized she had run away from. "Things were difficult until I was 40," Ashbury says, "but now they're better." Virginia Ashbury has worked in social services since 1991. Ashbury's voice will sound familiar to Life Rattle listeners. She has been at the helm of Life Rattle Radio since co-founder Arnie Achtman died in 2005. Her loyalty, determination, and energy kept Life Rattle Radio on the air. In tonight's show, you will have the pleasure of listening to her stories. Ashbury's writing doesn't pull any punches. Her observations can cut like a knife, or offer the voice of a trusted friend, someone you want in your corner when things get rough. Either way, Ashbury's writing always stands out as honest and believable. Please note, tonight's stories, written for and about adults, include material that some listeners might find offensive. Parental discretion is advised. Let's listen now to A Walk in the Park, tonight's first story, written and read by Virginia Ashbury.
A Walk in the Park by Virginia Ashbury. Ah, another day done. I snap off my computer, stand up, and stretch backward in a delicious arch with my fists kneading the muscle knots in the small of my back. Grabbing my bag, I stride toward the exit with more energy than I've displayed all day. There's still 5 minutes left before I'm officially off work, so I veer into the washroom on my way, keeping to my policy of peeing on company time whenever possible. Donna is leaning over the far sink with her nose almost touching the mirror. She's lining her lips with a thin-tipped brush that glows purple on the end, drawing with the slow, rapt precision of an art restoration expert. I head into the last stall and take a seat. I don't like to talk from this position, but Donna isn't troubled by such conventions. "What are you up to tonight?" she drawls between strokes. Now here's dangerous territory. If I tell her that I'm just going to meander home through town, she may want to divert me to a stroll through the Eaton Center. That means 2 hours of forced admiration of makeup colors, sweaters, tight skirts, and all other consumer items I've managed to live without. We must look like a classic mismatched pair. Her right off a Holt Renfrew advertisement, and me the dumpy urban warrior. "Gotta go pick up the granddaughter from daycare," I lie through the door. That one can never be trumped. "Oh, that's nice," she sighs. "It's payday. She's gotta be hurting for a spree, but I need to wander." As I leave the stall, she's on to the filling in between the lines part. I wash my hands and then dry them on my jeans to save time as I put my back to the door, shove it open, and wave by in one action. The elevator is crowded with escapees from the fourth floor as I get on at the third. When we stop at the second floor, Miguel squeezes on. This is always a treat. He's such a slut, but a nice slut. We use the crowded condition as an excuse to pretend a few salsa moves to alarm the office manager who's right behind me. We've both abandoned any hopes of advancement in this industry. Nothing to lose is very liberating. At the ground floor, we make kissy noises at each other as the door closes to take Miguel and our pinch-faced boss to the garage level. Taking the corner in the exit hall, I see Bobby sitting in her massive wheelchair waiting for Wheeltrans. "Hey, Bobby, you waited for me. That's so sweet." I call ahead to her with our everyday joke. Bobby waits at least half an hour every night for her ride, so we like to employ a little irony. Pausing for a few minutes, we compare notes on office gossip. Whenever I can, I try to wait and keep Bobby company till her ride comes, but tonight I want to get out while there's still light. She understands. Walking south from Wellesley on Jarvis to Carlton Street is effortless. It's all downhill to the lake. Across the street is the Red Lion restaurant, where, upstairs till a few months ago, Ben Wicks had his office. Sometimes we rode the same Wellesley bus in the morning heading to work. The last time I saw him, a lady and her daughter got on at the station with us. The mother recognized him right off and whispered excitedly to the girl while pointing shyly at Ben. I think it must have been satisfying to be known for something so gentle and constructive as cartoons. When I win the lottery, I will rent that office that was Ben's. I'm counting on it being haunted by his spirit. We'll spend hours trading ideas and insults. It will be wonderful. At Carlton Street, I cut across to Allen Gardens. Nobody who wants to live can go into the gardens after nightfall, but it's only 4:45, so I'm safe for now. I always avoid the northwest corner of the park where dog owners are allowed to let their cuddly, frisky little 80-pound Rottweilers run free. Entering the park on the east side of the church, I head down the pathway that cuts diagonally from the northwest to southeast. The oak trees are bare this time of year, but even more stately in their nakedness. The gnarled knots on thick boughs look like menacing gargoyles. They have their work cut out for them in this part of town. There are more demons to be purged per square inch in this neighborhood than most. The canopy of black tendrils reaching for the evening sky is broken only by the pathways that meander through the park and around the atrium at its center. Closed at this time of day, there's no risk the atrium's excessive beauty will distract me from the action on the walkways. As I cross the central intersection of pathways in front of the atrium, a big guy in a dark winter jacket and blue maple leaf toque riding a mountain bike swerves around my left side, nearly catching my arm on his wide, straight handlebars. Before I can turn and swear at him, he speeds out of earshot. That's one. Just a few more steps along the pathway, a large golden retriever is bounding straight at me. The dog races to within inches of me. I've stopped, braced ready for the impact, but it veers off at the last second. A tall woman with hair that matches the dog's is grinning at me as she approaches. "Your dog?" I ask. "Yes," she answers, not as a statement but a sneer. "Well, I carry a knife with me for just that reason," I tell her as we pass. "Put your dog on a leash," I call over my shoulder. "What kind of fucking bitch are you?" she yells at me over the 30-foot distance between us now. I stop, turn, and yell back. "Put your dog on a leash, bitch," she yells back. "Yes, I am," I call back. Then in a steady, loud voice, "So protect your dog. Put it on a leash. That's two." Now I'm almost at the end of the path, near Sherburn and Gerard. On my left, I notice a tall, ragged man leaning against a tree. He's wearing the uniform of the street, a long parka, a hat so worn and weathered that the shape is indefinable, and all his clothes are all the same shade of gray filth. His unusual angle grabs my attention. He's leaning his upper shoulders on the tree, and the rest of his body is at a rigid 30-degree angle. As I come alongside, I realize that he has his pants pulled down below the bottom of his long coat. "Oh, Christ, a flasher," I think. But no, he's not flashing. He's defecating. That's three. I catch the next Sherburn bus south.
That was Virginia Ashbery reading her story, A Walk in the Park. Now let's listen to tonight's second story, Lunch, written and read by Virginia Ashbery.
Lunch by Virginia Ashbery. It's 12:55 and lunchtime is almost over. Three of us remain at our usual table with the debris of our meals scattered amid movie magazines and tabloids that have served as comic relief. We've reached a consensus on which actresses are overdressed, underdressed, or just plain slutty. This is always the point when women's lunchtime conversation turns to the necessary subject of actors we would or would not want to sleep with. Dibs on Tom Cruise, Jenny calls out loud and fast. Damn, Mary smirks. Then I guess I'm stuck with Brad Pitt again. They're both just pretty boys, I say, still shitting yellow. Mary turns sideways and leans toward me. And just who would you invite into your boudoir? Funny you should put it that way, I say, smiling and staring upward to the ceiling. Gerard Depardieu, I sigh. Oh God, those eyes. There is silence for the count of three, then both Mary and Jenny blast out with laughter. Mary slaps the table, cutlery rattles, and Tupperware topples to the floor. I don't mind their ridicule. Someday he will be mine, I declare proudly. I have taken 20 hours of Francais debutante so that when we meet, I can state my desires clearly. They don't hear me. They're still laughing and cleaning up. Where's Dorothy? Mary says. We've got to hear about her lust for Sean Connery. Gone to the chiropractor, I say. Then, like it was a cue, Dorothy walks into the room. She's moving a little easier. Her limp is not so pronounced. But I can tell she is taking every step with care. As she lowers herself onto the chair on my left, I see pain clouding her eyes and her mouth set in a rigid, tight, straight line. Not a good treatment, I ask. He didn't do much of an adjustment, Dorothy says in a weak puff of speech. He's worried about my heart. So am I. I become alarmed. Dorothy's health has been in decline since shortly after we met 2 years ago. Early in 1994, we had both transferred as caseworkers from different locations to an office on Adelaide Street. Within 3 months of her arrival, Dorothy's arthritis became so severe she had to get a scooter. Soon after that, she had a heart attack. Now I have to tell you, Dorothy is what people call an A-type. Even with a lower caseload, she did more work than two others. For her, this amounted to a reduction from doing up to four times more work than anyone else. Dorothy needed a break, but hated asking for what she thought were special favors. A vocal minority of young people in the office resented Dorothy's reduction in workload. They had their strength, knew that they would marry well, stay healthy, and believed that anyone over the age of 50 has enough money to retire. Management was inclined to accommodate only what was demanded by a sick worker and supported in writing by their doctor. Statistical requirements must be met. Empathy does not serve the bottom line. 2 years later, after the Adelaide site closed, Dorothy and I are working at the Wellesley Jarvis office, and the political climate is even worse for her health. The management here gives Dorothy a full caseload, but calls it half. So here we sit in the lunchroom, scared. Jenny has left to see a client at 1 o'clock. Dorothy, Mary, and I remain. The rest of the room has cleared. Tell me what you feel, I say to Dorothy in a whisper. I'm having palpitations. I feel so cold. The chiropractor took my blood pressure. Oh God, she says, holding her head in both hands. Dorothy, you have to go to the hospital, I say, putting my hand on her right shoulder. I can feel her shaking. No, she demands, I'll be okay. I just need to rest. I'll sit here for a while. It'll pass. I don't want to go there. I have too much to do. I'll be okay. Denial. That's the third indicator of a heart attack. We've been over this list more than once. She knows that I know. Well, I'll stay here with you, but I've got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back, I say, and leave Dorothy with Mary. I rush about the office looking for a supervisor. I find Leonard on the same floor, tell him that I'm afraid Dorothy is having a heart attack, but that she thinks she's okay. He should call 911. Well, I don't know, he says. Dorothy has had an attack before, so she'll know best if this is really a problem. It should be her call. No, you don't understand. Denial is one of the signs, I tell him. He looks puzzled, then annoyed. If she wants to go to the hospital, I'm sure she'll say something. He turns and walks away. On the next floor down, I find another supervisor. By now, I remember the part of emergency first aid training where we were told that if anyone complains of chest pains, management must call an ambulance, regardless of the wishes of the worker, behind their back if necessary, but right away. Only management is allowed to call 911. I tell the supervisor what's going on in the lunchroom. She says she'll talk to the manager when she gets back from lunch at 2 o'clock. My eyes fill with tears. I feel powerless and weak. I hurry back to the lunchroom. Dorothy isn't there. Mary says she's gone to lie down in the sick room. With each footstep down the long hallway, my dread increases. Dorothy lies on the green plastic bench in the dark, tears filling both eyes and overflowing down her cheeks. She's on her back, legs straight out like she's practicing for the grave. She's aware that I've entered the room but says nothing. Her crying is silent. I'll be right back, I whisper. One more try, then I'll have to do it myself. Just around the corner from the sick room, I find Susan in her office. I tell her quickly about Dorothy and that I've already asked two other supervisors to call 911. Oh, Christ, she snarls and reaches for the phone. Go stay with Dorothy, she says, as she waits to be connected. Back in the sick room, I sit beside Dorothy and hold her hand. I don't tell her the ambulance is coming, but she knows. We talk about pressures, expectations she feels from others, and more importantly, from herself. We keep our conversation focused on the future. Three firemen appear at the door, along with two ambulance attendants, at least six cases of equipment, and a gurney with crisp white sheets. Dorothy is quickly seated and swaddled, belted, and hooked up to an intravenous drip. The ambulance attendant takes information from Dorothy and then starts berating her for not calling sooner. Her blood pressure is 220 over 140. I leave the area and go to my supervisor's office. She's back from lunch. Caroline, I say, Dorothy is being taken to hospital. I'm going with her. Oh, she pauses and looks at the schedule on the wall beside her desk. I don't know if we can spare the manpower. I'll have to ask the manager if it's okay. I feel cold. My vision tunnels. I have 3 hours loo time owing to me. I'll be taking that now, I say from between clenched teeth, then turn and leave the office before she can answer. The hallway by the sick room is crowded. Three supervisors, the manager, and at least seven other workers watch the show. Dorothy looks less worried, calmer, but annoyed. This is not a spectator sport, she snaps at the crowd. They disperse quickly. Now I know she'll be okay.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Lunch. Now let's listen to tonight's third story, Gnomes, written and read by Virginia Ashbury.
Gnomes by Virginia Ashbery. Hi, Virg. How was your day? Jean says, chirpy, cheerful. She's got call display, a spy phone. She says it's turned hello into I know for her. Well, Jean, what's more important is how are you? Any more Rob sightings? No, just this morning. Sorry, I couldn't say more when you called me at work, but you know, they all think he's backed off. Christ, I can't believe him, she says, the cheer gone. What did he do this time? Follow you again? No, oh no, he's up the ante. You know that light right by Tim Hortons? The one just up from my place? Yeah. I was about 6 cars back. It was red. Then there he is at the passenger side window, banging on it. He waved me into the parking lot. You pulled in? I know, it sounds stupid, but when he gets like this, when he's out of control, it's better to let him talk where other people are around, do you see? Yeah, I guess so. You know him best, but, well, he could misinterpret. I just know if I don't let him blow it off, he'll come here. But you've got the button to push. You will push it, won't you? Yeah, sure, of course, but do you really think those idiots at 41 Division will get their fingers out of their asses and get over here before he kills me? Do you know what I found out yet today? He's not even on CPIC yet. I had Judy, the court cop at work, run his name. Those bastards at 41 haven't even gotten around to putting the paperwork through. If Rob comes here, and let's say I'm here with Jason, and I push the button, then Rob leaves, when the police get here, they'd take Jason in, no matter what I say, because they think he's the bad guy, because they don't know who the bad guy really is, and I'm just saying he's my son because I'm intimidated. I'd have to go out and bail out my own kid. They didn't learn a damn thing from the May Isles inquiry. He's not on CPIC? Nope. Shit. Yeah. What'd he want? The usual. He loves me, wants to come back. It's my fault for calling the cops, him going to jail, the probation order keeping him away. Broken record? Uh-huh. Were you able to get to work on time? Yeah, I think he must have had some work today, too. There was the ladder on top of his truck. Some guy, I don't know, was in the passenger seat. Jean's three dogs, the girls, start barking. The little one's really loud, like someone's at the door. You okay? Is someone there? Nah, it's the people next door. What the hell are they doing? The dogs are going nuts. It's garbage night. They do this every week. I don't get it. They put out these big, clear plastic bags. You know, the really big ones? Every week, at least four. One for each of them, I guess. Full of pop cans. Not diet pop, either. Mostly Coke. The four of them drink cases of it every week. None of them are what you'd call small. Not Mum, Pop, or the boys. They're all big. I'd be surprised if they all don't end up diabetic. These are the boys who are both in their 40s, the ones you told me about, still living at home with Mum and Dad? Yep, I never see any of them all week, except garbage day. The boys are still working nights at the post office, I guess. Then Mondays, I see all of them. It's weird. They put out the garbage, and then all night long, they take turns coming out, rearranging the bags. They move them around. No point to it. Each one in turn, they just come out and move the bags from here to there, then back again. All those pop cans rattling. It gets the girls barking. Must drive you nuts. They're weird, really weird. Have I ever told you how they water their flowers at night? Well, what's strange about that? They're all plastic. The flowers? Yeah, all of them. Shit. And the lawn ornaments? The ones in the backyard? Oh, the gnomes? Windmill? All that stuff? Yeah. They take them in every winter, but before they do, they bring out heavy round paving stones to mark their spots, like it would matter. like they forget where everything goes. They keep adding to it, too. Have you noticed the lighthouse, the little balcony on it? No. It's got McDonald action figures all around it. Beauty, the Beast, two different Barbies, Sinbad, a bear, all living happily together. Well, that's kind of nice. Well, one day last year, they brought home a big purple plastic palm tree. Rob called me quick to the window. We watched it go into their garage. Rob said he wouldn't put up with that. He'd rip it out if they put it in the backyard. Did he? It never showed up there. Good thing. Yeah, I don't need neighbor problems, too. That's for sure. You going to bed soon? The girls have settled down now. I'd better get to bed. I'm working early traffic court tomorrow. You have a good night, then, Jean. Keep safe. You too, Verge. Jean, you will push the button if he comes around? Sure, Verge. Sure.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Gnomes. Now let's listen to tonight's final story, Dot, written and read by Virginia Ashbury.
Dot, by Virginia Ashbury. I never knew my mother-in-law. She was at least 10 years dead when I met my husband. All I know of Dorothy Jean Clark, née Roberts, comes from the few stories her son David told me. I know that Dorothy was a heavy smoker all of her adult life till she died from lung disease at age 46. She was one of those working-class English women, like Flo in Andy Cap cartoons. She did her sweeping, ironing, and cooking, all with a fag hanging out the corner of her mouth. Dorothy wore flowery print house dresses, covered over by flowery print two-pocketed aprons every day, all day, except at dinner time, when she would reach behind, undo the strings of her apron, and hang it on the hook on the bit of wall between the kitchen and dining room. For 30 minutes a day, while she ate dinner with her husband, then eventually two sons, she was separated from her cigarettes. They sat in a tin in her left apron pocket, while in the right pocket she kept a hanky, for when a coughing fit hit her and she had nowhere else to spit the brown phlegm. One day in early 1941, Dorothy heard a knock at the kitchen door. She put down the broom or iron or pot she was busy with and answered. On her doorstep stood a tiny old woman, 3 inches shorter than Dorothy's 5 feet. A red, blue, and green bandana tightly encircled the top of her bowed head. A thin, gray wool blanket with red and white stripes along its frayed edges wrapped her shoulders. The woman spoke in a whisper, keeping her face down and unseen. "For just 1 shilling, lady, I will tell you a truth that you will remember the whole of your life. I am Gypsy. I have the sight." Dorothy, Dot to her friends, took the cigarette out of her mouth, smiled just a little, and didn't say anything. But, because all of England was braced for invasion by the Boche, and she was pregnant with my husband, she certainly could not pass up any hints of the future offered from even the most suspect sources. Dot went to her pin money jar and fetched a shilling. The old woman snatched and pocketed the coin in one motion. Then, lifting her head, she focused her right eye directly at Dot, while her left eye, all milky and red, remained downward gazing. She raised her gnarled right index finger up slowly, touching it first to her weather-chapped and wrinkled forehead, then pointing it to the same spot on Dot's face. The old lady took a long, wheezing breath and spoke. "If you tie a knot in the end of your thread when you sew, your stitches will never loosen. With the last word spoken, the old lady slipped away around the corner of the house and was gone. Dot looked down at her left hand, where her cigarette had been waiting a full minute since she'd last attended to it. She knocked off the loose ash, revealing its warm red glow, and returned it to her mouth in one swift action. So now, there you have it. That small piece of knowledge, insignificant but true, is now yours for free.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Dot. That concludes Life Rattle number 1177. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Virginia Ashbury reading her stories. Life Rattle will bring you more stories next Sunday night at 9 o'clock. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.